onto the shoulders of the lucky few who retain their jobs. The startup field can feel like the Wild West, with new, well-funded companies emerging overnight offering young employees major perks like free office food and ping-pong tables to counterbalance the intensity of the work environment. The rising awareness of issues of social justice, climate change, and the toxic byproducts of a consumer society is tearing some workers in two. Economically, they need their jobs, but ethically, they don't support the products or services their company provides. Retirement security is no longer secure. Only 7% of corporations still offer defined benefit pension plans. 25% offer hybrids with defined contributions, such as 401ks plus some cash. The rest are shifting saving for retirement back onto the shoulder of the workers. Some people even wonder about the long-term security of our national Social Security safety net. This, of course, is what brings many people to this book. You want to take your retirement fully into your own hands and on your own timetable, no matter what happens out there. According to a 2014 report by the Conference Board, a New York-based nonprofit research group, the majority of Americans are unhappy at work. In their first survey in 1987, 61.1% of workers said they liked their jobs. But that was the high point. The all-time low was 2010, when only 42.6% of workers said they liked their jobs. As the prospects for long-term work with the same employer have eroded and employees have been saddled with ever higher health plan deductibles and payroll deductions, the two categories in which workers' satisfaction fell the most were job security and health plans, both declining by at least 11 points since 1987. We've had enough, it would seem, of making a dying in such a crazy world. Even if we like our professions, even if we lucked out in the workplace lottery, even if we are among the 50% not dissatisfied, we still suffer from job-charming syndrome. We might still seek to fill needs that jobs can never fulfill. We might risk that ultimate deathbed regret. Why did I spend so much time at my job? What is the purpose of work? Let's continue our exploration of work, this most personal and profound relationship, by reflecting on a few questions. Why do you do what you do to earn money? What motivates you to get out of bed, to go somewhere, to make money? What is the purpose, in your experience, of your paid employment? If you are supported by a working spouse or relative, you can reflect either on why that breadwinner works or on some work experience from your past. If you are retired or unemployed, think about a job you once had. Now consider the following list of various purposes of paid employment and see which ones apply to you. Earning money, to provide for oneself and the family, to save for the future, to engage in philanthropy, to achieve financial independence. A sense of security, to ensure that your place at the company is assured, to ensure that you'll have benefits. Tradition, to carry on a family tradition of following a particular profession, to fulfill a duty to your family, because everyone works. Service, to do your fair share, to make a contribution to other society and the world, to be the change you wish to see in the world, aligning skills with helping others. Learning, to acquire new skills, grow as a human, become more marketable, to be stimulated and challenged, to innovate and create. Power, to influence other people, to influence decisions and outcomes, to assure respect and admiration for those you want to impress, to achieve success and prominence in your field. Socializing, to enjoy connecting with your coworkers, to interact with other people and feel part of a larger community, to engage in company-wide events and parties. Time structuring, to structure your time and give an orderly rhythm to your life. Have you noticed that work has two different functions? The material financial function, i.e. getting paid, and the personal function, emotional, intellectual, psychological, and even spiritual. The original question was, what is the purpose served by paid employment? In reality, there is only one purpose served by paid employment, getting paid. That is the only real link between work and money. The other purposes of paid employment are other types of rewards which are certainly desirable but not directly related to getting paid. They are all equally available in unpaid activities. For middle-class workers and up, any stress, confusion, or disappointment we might feel concerning our paid employment is rarely because of the pay itself. We've already seen that beyond a certain level of comfort, more money does not bring more satisfaction. Perhaps the trouble with our paid employment, then, is that our needs for stimulation and recognition for growth, contribution, interaction, and meaning are not being met by our jobs. The Conference Board's survey of job satisfaction referred to earlier supports this. Growth potential, communication challenges, interest in work, and recognition make a job satisfying, not pay. What if we removed most of these expectations from our paid employment and recognized that all purposes for work other than earning money could be fulfilled by unpaid activities? This observation brings up a critical point in re-examining our relationship with work. There are two sides to work. One side is our need and desire for money. We work in order to get paid to afford our basic human needs. The other side, totally separate from our wages, is the fact that we work in order to fulfill many other positive goals in our lives. It should be noticed that this may not be true for the millions who do not earn enough, even with two jobs, to support themselves and their families. The United States is the only advanced economy in the world without guaranteed paid vacation, and less than half of low-wage workers get any paid vacation time. Breaking the link between work and wages. The real problem with work, then, is not that our expectations are too high. It's that we have confused work with paid employment. Redefining work as simply any productive or purposeful activity, with paid employment being just one activity among many, frees us from the false assumption that what we do to put food on the table and a roof over our heads should also provide us with a sense of meaning, purpose, and fulfillment. Breaking the link between work and money allows us to reclaim balance and sanity. Our fulfillment as human beings lies not in our jobs, but in the whole picture of our lives, in our inner sense of what life is about, our connectedness with others, and our yearning for meaning and purpose. By separating work and wages, we actually open the door to integrating all parts of our lives, from earning money to loving our families, into one whole called, quote-unquote, who we really are. When we are whole, we don't need to try to consume our way to happiness. Happiness is our birthright. Whether you love or hate your paid employment, by separating work and wages, you can see more clearly whether you are valuing, both on and off the job, that precious commodity called your life energy. Remember from our discussion about life energy in Chapter 2 that a 40-year-old would have about 350,000 hours left. With a third dedicated to sleeping and 15% dedicated to the necessary activities of having a body and a roof over your head, like cooking, cleaning, fixing stuff, and errands, you can divide your hours bank account in half. These hours are all you've got. There's nothing in your life that is more valuable than your time, the moments you have left. Separating work from wages means all moments in your life matter. And reclaiming more moments to spend as you will, not as you must, is a worthy goal indeed. Breaking the link between work and wages has as much power in our lives as the recognition that money is simply something we trade our life energy for. Money is our life energy. It takes its value not from external definitions, but from what we invest in it. Similarly, paid employment takes its only intrinsic value from the fact that we are paid to do it. Everything else we do is an expression of who we are, not what we must do out of economic necessity. By breaking the link, we regain quality, values, self-worth as our bottom line. By breaking the link, we can redefine work simply as whatever we do in alignment with our purpose in life. By breaking the link, we get our lives back. The stunning implications of breaking the link. From this point of view, it's clear why your paid employment may feel like making a dying. Besides earning money, you may be doing nothing else on the job that is in alignment with your purpose. 8 to 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year, 40 or more years of your life. This opens up a host of questions. How much money do you need to be at the peak of your fulfillment? Is your job providing that amount? Are you working for less than you're worth and bringing home less money than you need? Or are you earning far more than you need for fulfillment? What is the purpose of that extra money? If it serves no purpose, would you want to work less and have more time to do what matters to you? If it does serve a purpose, is that purpose so clear and so connected with your values that it brings an experience of joy to your hours at your paid employment? If not, what needs to change? Let's explore together some of the implications of redefining work by breaking the link between work and wages, of seeing paid employment as distinct from work, work in the sense of fulfillment of purposes in life. People at both ends of the age spectrum are already doing this, but not necessarily in an empowered way. Many millennials began their working lives after the financial meltdown of 2008, when the stock market lost half its value. If they followed their parents' script, went to college, and took on debt, expecting their parents' results, they were greeted with an economy in free fall and few opportunities in the traditional job market. No wonder they are such entrepreneurs, side hackers, and gig economy workers. No wonder they have to brand themselves to go out into the fast-changing world where niches open, get filled, and close in a matter of months. Coders, bloggers, app designers, and entrepreneurs work long, uncompensated hours and often come up empty. No wonder as well that millennials have revived interest in this book and the possibility of financial independence. They already have multiple facets to their lives, some that make money, some as hobbies, some as passions, some as quirks. On the other end of the scale, many boomers are entering their Social Security years with only Social Security. They too have to figure out how to make money doing odd and not so odd jobs. With sufficient retirement income, they can play with the grandkids. Without, they might play with other people's children for pay. If you worked at only one company for most of your career, it takes oomph to put yourself out into the world where ageism runs rampant. Millennials have that in abundance. Boomers, not so much. This said, those among you in your vast middle working years, consider these advantages of separating work from income. It will inspire you on your path of transforming your relationship with money and may well lead to early retirement, or at least to retirement that gives you freedom rather than worry. 1. Redefining work increases choices. Let's say you are a natural-born teacher, but you took a job as a computer programmer because you can make more money, which you are convinced you really need. In the old way of thinking, every time someone asked you what you do, you would be forced to affirm, "I am a computer programmer." What do you suppose the effect on you might be of this long-term incongruity between your inner sense of yourself and your outer presentation? You might be just mildly unhappy and not know why. You might get ill, as one friend of ours did when she gave up her dream of being a concert pianist and became a programmer instead. She developed an inexplicable illness that put her on disability for nearly a year. You might run up a credit card debt to reward yourself for doing something that doesn't suit you. The other thing you might overlook, though, is questioning whether or not you are a computer programmer just because that's what you do to make a living. When you do break the link between work and wages, another option opens up. When you are asked what you do, you can say, "I am a teacher, but currently I'm writing computer programs to make money." Being able to acknowledge who you really are allows you to reevaluate how you've structured your career. You might decide to save money and go back to school for your teaching credentials. You might decide to reduce your programming hours so that you can volunteer as a teacher. You might decide to teach computer programming. You might bring it a third love, like kayaking, and teach that on weekends while you program computers for money. Disconnecting work from wages allows the various parts of your compartmentalized life to break loose, slide around, and rearrange themselves in a pattern that serves you better. Donna O. worked her way up the ladder of success, but found the grind did not suit her sensibilities. As a doctor, she found herself trying to promote health in an unhealthy system, one that demanded 100-hour work weeks, not enough sleep, and precious little time for doing anything else. During her residency and early years as a physician, she found the work so all-consuming that she had no time to think about money and no time to consider how she was spending it. Marrying another doctor only doubled the pattern of unconsciousness. Donna and her husband accumulated houses and cars and exotic investments. The thought of keeping track of their spending was beyond comprehension. They confused consciousness with worry, and they had enough to worry about in practicing medicine. But Donna's days as a super doc were numbered. The birth of her two children reminded her of what matters most. She wanted out of the medical business and back into a caring and balanced profession. With a mixture of trepidation and resolve, she left her secure medical group with all its benefits and opened a clinic for women staffed by women that would reflect her values. About this time, she listened to the original FI audio course published in 1984. In her enthusiasm, she immediately went to her husband and asked him the question she was beginning to ask herself. "What would you do if you didn't have to work for money?" "What do you mean?" he replied. "I love my work." "But what if you never had to charge anyone to meet your overhead?" Unable to answer the question, he promptly went to sleep. Eventually, he listened to the course, but his zeal for a new way of practicing medicine did not match Donna's. She began to work on the steps of the program, but still felt out of step with her husband. She finally came to the conclusion that even in a conventional marriage, or perhaps especially in a conventional marriage, a woman has to be willing to live a life of her own. She did the steps on her own. As her personal insights grew, she began to reevaluate her clinic. None of the staff wanted to work the long and arduous hours maintained by mainstream medical professionals, but they all had trouble adjusting to earning less money. Expensive procedures are what pay the bills for most physicians. Donna preferred prevention, yet the economics of medicine kept pulling her back into the old way of working. "Either I have to do medicine differently or not do it at all." For Donna, financial independence is the whole process of recovery from old ways of thinking about money, work, meaning, and purpose. If a healthy practice of medicine means less money, well, so be it. Donna is not alone. A nationwide survey done by the Center for New American Dream found that nearly half of Americans had made voluntary changes in their lives that resulted in making less money. Those who did reported being happy with the changes and said that the major motivations for making less money were reducing stress, striking a balance in their lives, and having more free time. 2. Redefining work allows you to work from the inside out. For many of us, much of life is lived from the outside in, selecting our roles and personas like dishes at a Chinese restaurant. One person might select fireman from the job column, blonde hair and blue eyes from the wife column, two from the children column, casual from the style column, Toyota from the car column, Republican from the political column, and condo from the housing column, and figure he's got life pretty well squared away. Fitting our well-rounded selves into a square hole called job reinforces this impression that life consists of selecting options from a fixed list. Unless you're an artist or entrepreneur, most often your job consists of working with someone else's agenda, for which service you are paid. There's a kind of subtle yet pervasive irresponsibility in the work world, a sense that we're always doing someone else's bidding, angling to please someone else up the line a bit. In large corporations, most workers don't even have a clue who originated the plan they're diligently getting to work. And such corporations buy not only our work, but our personalities as well, with their unspoken cultural norms about who talks with whom, what to wear, where people at various levels do lunch, how much overtime you have to put in to be visible, and hundreds of other daily choices. It's clear that if we think what we do to make money is who we are, we will end up adopting whatever pattern will allow us to survive best at our jobs. But if who you are and what you do to make money are distinct, as they can be when you disconnect work from wages, you can reclaim your lost self. As you come to know yourself, your values, your beliefs, your real talents, and what you care about, you will be able to work from the inside out. You will be able to do your job without giving up yourself. Margaret P. is in the process of shifting from living according to others' values, living from the outside in, to discovering and living her values, living from the inside out. She'd already been married, had two children, and gotten a divorce. As a single parent with a strong sense of duty, she wanted to earn as much as possible to support her family, so she gave up teaching and became a certified financial planner. She worked on commission, and some products were more lucrative than others. The conflict between the profits and her clients' best interests gave her stomach pains, and she realized she had to stop selling financial products at all costs. She stopped pursuing sales. While her body got better, her personal financial picture got worse. She was glad that she and IVU had started the financial independence support group of 20 people committed to working with the FI program. As they followed the steps of the program, they found themselves ever more willing to follow the promptings of their heart. And for each of them, that looked slightly different. For example, through honoring her life energy, one woman saw that she was wasting her talent in a bog of mediocrity. She said, "They aren't paying me enough to stay here in this amount of pain." So she quit and lived on savings until she found other work. All of these changes came out of the process of doing the steps in the program. 3. Redefining work makes us life designers, not just wage earners. Before the Industrial Revolution, most people were farmers, meaning they were able to build, maintain, and fix almost everything they needed for daily life. Post-Industrial Revolution, especially post-Information and Tech Revolutions, we learned to spend most of our time selling one small slice of our talents to pay for everything else we need. Lose your job, though, and you still have a mortgage, car payments, and credit card payments without anything coming in. Disconnecting work from wages, however, opens the door to valuing the big piece of the pie called the rest of your time. Few go back to being Jacks and Jills of all trades, such as farmers or home builders. But the more we learn to honor unpaid work, the more likely our debt will be lower. We might learn handyman skills, or build that deck outside ourselves, or host a website, or launch a blog. When we stop working for money, we may be out of a job, but we are not out of work. It also means that play might end up being pay. You might learn skills in a job that you take into your life. You may learn lessons in your life that later you're paid for. The skills acquired in one job may lead to another. On one job, you may learn the ins and outs of a trade so that you can leave the job and ply the trade for fun or profit. Job becomes school. School becomes play. Work becomes self-expression. You are your boss, whether you're paid or not, and you can carve out your own path. 4. Redefining work adds life to your retirement. Retirement doesn't mean you stop working. It means you can stop working for money. We all want to be useful, to be recognized by others for the contribution we make. If we think paid employment is our only admirable, respectable, and consequential way to contribute, then who'd want to retire? Nobody wants to be a has-been, washed up, put out to pasture. Disconnecting work from wages means that you are valuable in every role, task, activity, and it might free you to retire a lot earlier so you can give more of yourself to others. 5. Redefining work honors unpaid activity. Nancy got tired of hearing herself say, "I don't know where my day went," each evening as she looked at how little she crossed off her to-do list. She tracked her money to get a handle on where it all went. Maybe she could do it for time as well. For a week, every 15 minutes, she noted what she'd done in that time slot. She soon realized that she spent most of her time on activities she didn't consider important: cleaning, cooking, shopping, and chatting with family members. Her official list had only work-related tasks: a meeting with a colleague, responding to emails. Everything else, which was most of her time, wasn't on her list at all. She realized that if she was paid to clean house, she'd have it on the list. Cleaning her own house? Nowhere. The exercise showed her that she bestowed status only on paid employment. Now she puts everything on her list and gets to be proud of all she's accomplished, paid or unpaid. Isn't it true that unpaid activity is often seen as worthless, as in worth less than paid activity? Isn't it true that there is an almost universal belief in our culture that if you are not working for money, not building a career, not employed, you are a nobody? Our inner work, the job of self-examination, self-development, and emotional and spiritual maturation, is just as crucial as paid work or housework or yard work. It takes time to know yourself, time for reflection, for prayer and ritual, for developing a coherent philosophy of life and personal code of ethics, and for setting personal goals and evaluating progress. Disconnecting work and wages does away with that painful erasure of self from our identification with our jobs. 6. Redefining work reunites work and play. Work is serious. Play is frivolous. Work is adult. Play is childish. Work is useful. Play is useless. Sometimes play may look like work, as in an intense chess game. Sometimes work can look like and even be called play, as in professional sports. And sometimes work feels so much like play that people say, somewhat guiltily, "This job is such fun, I shouldn't be paid for it." So how do we tell the difference between work and play? Both play and work can be competitive as well as cooperative. They can both build skill and give a sense of achievement. With both, you can enter a state of intense focus, concentration, and flow. In fact, from the outside, watching a person fully engaged in an activity, one would not know if he or she was being paid or just playing. This is the power of disconnecting work and wages. You reconnect work and play so that your whole life can glow with enjoyment. 7. Redefining work allows you to enjoy your leisure more. For the Greeks, leisure was the highest good, the essence of freedom, a time for self-development and higher pursuits. Yet here we are in the early 21st century, unable to really relax and enjoy our leisure. Even our language betrays us by calling it time off, as though leisure were just a few minutes of recuperation before we're back on, a once again productive, i.e. real, human being. If we did not identify so strongly with what we do for money, we might honor and enjoy our leisure more. It's okay to play. It's okay to relax in the shade and listen to the birds. It's okay to take a walk to nowhere in particular. It's okay to leave your technology at home and go camping. There's no shame in taking time to do activities alone either. It's okay to take pleasure in just being rather than doing. Leisure is not an identity crisis if you know you are not your job. Perhaps because our jobs are so laced into every hour of our days, we take our leisure in unconscious and unsatisfying ways, like those micro-vacations consisting of serially checking our phones while at work, for texts from friends, social media, maybe a recent skit from the late-night TV comic. Separating work from wages reminds us to work with focus while at work and focus fully on our chosen activities when our time is our own. 8. Redefining work sheds a new light on right livelihood. Right livelihood is the ideal of finding a way for your true work or vocation to be your paid work as well. Admirable though it is, there are pitfalls to this noble effort that the FI program neatly sidesteps. There is no guarantee that you will find someone to pay you to do what you feel called to do. It may take many years to develop your art or your research or your social innovation or your new technology to the point where those who have money will fund you. Crowdfunding is an innovative workaround for those long waits for government or foundation money. But a 2015 report from the London-based Crowdfunding Center found that between 70 and 90% of the campaigns failed, depending on the platform. Most often this has less to do with the real value of your work than it has to do with luck or chance, perseverance or connections, race or gender, and a host of other factors. By giving up the expectation that you will be paid to do the work you are passionate about, you can do both things with more integrity. You can make money to cover your expenses, and you can follow your heart without compromise. You can hold a vision for doing the work you love once you have retired, and let that dream fuel your passion to do your 9-step program with integrity and determination. You can treat your paid employment years like preparation for your full-time vocation, with each job teaching and honing important personal and work skills, as well as building networks. To whatever degree you've settled for work you don't love, if you have failed at being paid to do what you love, you can know that you have not really settled. You're just setting yourself up for your next move and ultimately your financial independence. New students in martial arts Aikido learn an exercise called the unbendable arm. Facing a partner with the top of one's wrist resting on the partner's collarbone, the student is told to resist as the partner uses two hands to pull down on his elbow. Try as he might, the student quickly loses. Then he is instructed to relax and feel energy flowing from his center in his belly out through his arm to infinity, as if it were water rushing through a fire hose. Now the partner, try as she might, cannot bend his arm. Putting your attention on getting paid actually diverts energy from engaging in your chosen forms of service. You're doing two things, not one. As with the unbendable arm, you can focus on resisting your partner, i.e. getting paid, or extending your energy towards infinity, your calling. Or consider what happens when commerce intervenes in the process of finding your calling, in the case of making art. In The Biology of Art, zoologist Desmond Morris tells of an experiment in introducing the profit motive to apes. The first step was teaching them to be artists and to produce drawings and paintings that were decidedly lovely. Once their art was established, he began to pay them, rewarding them with peanuts for their work. Under the reward system, their artwork quickly deteriorated and they began turning out hasty scrawls just to get the peanuts. Commercialism destroyed the apes as artists and got them scrambling for peanuts instead. Insisting that your calling and your paid employment be one and the same can tip the balance of your focus from mission to money. Achieving financial independence, meaning both freeing your mind and ultimately freeing your time, gives you an unbendable arm, no matter what your employment may be. Imagine you luck out and find that dream job, the one that marries who you are and how you earn money. But something happens. New management, your project shuts down, and the team is reabsorbed into the general pool. And you are confronted with money versus mission. If you disconnect work from wages, you stay clear on your true work and assess whether your situation will ultimately free you to do it without compromise. You return to the unbendable arm and choose. Implications for your income. Now that we've established that the only intrinsic purpose of paid employment is getting paid, whether you love or hate your job, it makes sense to see whether you are trading your precious life energy for what it's worth. Since you know that your life is bigger than your job, it makes sense to get a job that really does the job, that is, pays you well. This leads to step 7 of the FI program. Step 7, valuing your life energy, maximizing income. Step 7 is about increasing your income by valuing the life energy you invest in your job and exchanging it for the highest pay, consistent with your health and integrity. When you pick up your paycheck, tally up your gig checks, or tabulate all your combined income, are you really getting a fair exchange for your investment of valuable life energy? The key to freedom from the making a dying world is valuing your life energy. We have seen that money is just something you trade your life energy for. We have also recognized that the purpose of paid employment is getting paid. Don't reason and self-respect both suggest, then, that when you are working for pay, you should make the most money per hour possible, consistent with your integrity and your health? While that may seem like good old-fashioned greed, follow along and you'll find yourself headed in another direction altogether. In following steps 1 through 6, you have defined what enough is for you, including your best guess of how much will be enough in the future. Instead of defining enough as more than I have now, thus condemning yourself to the experience of perpetual poverty, you are discovering that enough may be less and closer than you imagined. And remember, enough is not the minimum amount for survival. It's the exact amount that gives you fulfillment without excess. As we pointed out in Chapter 5, this enough often falls far below your income. By spending less money than you earn, you can spend less time in the job and still have enough. It's basic math. If enough is $2,500 a month and you earn $25 an hour, you must work 100 hours a month to meet your expenses. But if you could earn $50 an hour, you could conceivably work 50 hours a month at your paid employment or save 50% of your income. Now we're moving back toward the lifestyle human beings enjoyed before the Industrial Revolution. You could work 2 or 3 hours a day as an independent contractor for money and spend the rest of the time doing what you want to do for relaxation, fun, self-development, human interaction, community involvement, or world service. If you choose to work more hours at your paid employment, you would do it only for a good reason, since you place a high value on your life energy. You might be doing it to get out of debt and experience that particular aspect of financial freedom. You might be doing it to develop savings so that you can be secure no matter what the economic climate is. Or you might be doing it so that you can achieve some other life goals, like going back to school or traveling around the world, or even becoming financially independent. The size and intensity of your goals will determine the time and vigor you invest in the workplace. You might even be so eager to reach a financial goal that you end up with several side gigs alongside your job, joyfully. Unlike the behavior of a workaholic, however, working extra hours is now connected with and serves your purpose. Disconnecting work from wages for Rosemary I meant that she could move toward pursuing other goals beyond her job, goals that ranged from travel to writing to working on projects that might help the planet. While she enjoyed her job as an activities director at a retirement home, she didn't plan to devote her whole life to it. She saw clearly that the more she earned now, the sooner she could get on with her other goals. Rather than searching for a higher-paying job with the possibility of more stress, she decided on another strategy. She got a second job, working on call with a small audio duplication and distribution company, putting in several hours a week on evenings and weekends. The schedule was flexible, the people congenial, the stress minimal, and her hourly pay was just as good as what she was getting at her full-time job. Even though she's working far more than 40 hours a week, her goal keeps her energy up and her spirits high. Valuing your life energy and seeking the highest pay possible has nothing to do with the more is better mentality. If money equals life energy, then by increasing your income, you increase the amount of life available to you. Depending on your actual hourly wage, a new car could cost a month, 6 months, or a year of work. And you don't want more money so that you can have more status, prestige, power, or security. You know that money doesn't buy these things. You want more money so that you can have more freedom to be yourself without worrying about money. Likewise, you don't want more money to boost your self-esteem. You want more money as an expression of your self-esteem, of valuing your life energy. New options for paid employment. You have several creative options to explore at this point, including increasing your pay so that you can work part-time, enhancing your current job, or changing jobs altogether. Higher pay, a matter of attitude. Many people are passive, even fatalistic, about the size of their earnings. They act out of a victim mentality, totally at the mercy of outside forces. The boss, the wage scale, the unemployment situation, the recession, the poor local economy, the president's economic policy, competition from low-paid workers in developing countries, and on and on. The attitude is one of, I can't find a good job, and it's because of them. They are keeping me in a low-paying job. While economic realities may at times be harsh, it is also the nature of the human mind to make real the thoughts and beliefs that we hold, a fact that should encourage greater care in how we think about ourselves. One important factor limiting your earning potential is attitude. Attitudes about yourself, as in, I'm not good enough, or about your job or employer, they're out to get me, and about current circumstances. There just aren't any jobs. If you see yourself as a victim, you may well be too busy feeling sorry for yourself to notice the many opportunities to change your dismal destiny. To be successful, cultivate positive attitudes of self-respect, pride in your contribution to your workplace, dedication to your job, cooperation with your employers and coworkers, desire to do the job right, personal integrity, responsibility, and accountability, and do it just because you value your life energy. Think how valuing your life energy might transform your experience and performance on your job, as well as your ability to get another job should you choose to want one. Wherever you are working for yourself. You are committed to excellence at your job because you're committed to 100% integrity no matter what you're doing. You'd be surprised at the degree to which job satisfaction lies in the worker, not the work. Ted Y., the carpenter we met in Chapter 6, found that one of the gifts of the FI program was the chance to reconnect with his aspirations as a writer. He'd grown up in an Air Force family and had kept moving as an adult. He finished high school in Gulfport, Mississippi, and then moved to Austin, Texas, where he employed 8 people in a remodel business until the oil crash ripped the rug out from under him. That and a divorce pared his possessions down to a van load, making step one very easy, and he took off, eventually landing in Oregon. Within a year of putting the FI program into practice, Ted had enough money saved to support himself for a year, allowing him to back away from the financial edge. He decided to try writing some stories that had been with him for years, stories based on his experiences in Mississippi in the early 1970s, when he built a Baptist church with some old African-American carpenters. To free up more time for writing, Ted started bidding his remodeling jobs a lot higher, assuming that most of these contracts wouldn't come through. What happened was a big surprise. Many people had been so impressed with his work in the past that they were willing to pay whatever he asked. He had all the work he wanted and much higher wages. Wanting to deliver the quality they were paying for, he put ever greater care into his carpentry. His reputation for superior craftsmanship spread, bringing in more work. His hours of paid employment went down, his income went up, his anxiety went down, his peace of mind went up, and his time to write seemed boundless. He was surprised, but he wasn't going to question his good fortune, or was it his good self-esteem? Financial independence as a part-time job. Ted Y chose what we usually refer to as part-time work. However, this new way of thinking about money and work puts that term in a new light. In the world of job equals identity, part-time work makes you only a part-time person who has only part-time worth. As a part-timer, this thinking concludes, you would be sacrificing many of the benefits of full-time employment. You'd lose out on health insurance and whatever retirement plans your company provides. You'd lose out on opportunities for advancement. In the new way of thinking, however, you are working part-time on someone else's agenda for money, so you can work as much time as possible on your own agenda. You give your employers their money's worth, but you don't define your self-worth by what you do on the job. People have adopted a number of variations on this theme of part-time work. Some work a shorter work week. Some work 6 months a year for money and do their art, travel, volunteering, or play the other 6 months. Some work 4 hours a day so that they can be available for their children before and after school. Some ask their boss for what they need. Why not? Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Consider renegotiating your vacation time, asking your boss to let you work 24 hours a week, or detailing why telecommuting will make you a better employee. But what if I like my job? If you like your job, this new perspective, valuing your life energy, will only enhance your experience and your earnings. Maddie C., who is partners with Tom C., the propane truck driver, loves her work as a holistic accountant, empowering people to become responsible with their money. Upon doing the FI course, she discovered the blind spots in her own personal finances. When she calculated her real hourly wage, she found out that out of her $90 per hour fee, she netted $7.50. Her husband did better delivering propane in the winter in rural Maine. Where was that money going? Because she had wanted to provide service for people who couldn't afford it, she offered discount rates to low-income people and was always the one to do unpaid overtime and go the extra mile. Doing the monthly tabulation showed her that she wasn't making any headway economically. She had forgotten the simple lesson of valuing her own life energy. She decided to raise her rates by 23% and to limit her staff to one secretary. In addition, she decided to limit both the number of clients, concentrating on those who wanted to learn to help themselves, and the number of hours she worked. After making these changes, she found herself with exactly the number and type of clients she wanted, and she now works fewer hours while earning more money. But what if I don't have or want a job? There are many reasons people don't have or want a job in the traditional sense. They can be self-employed, entrepreneurs, on-call as handymen or dog walkers, artists of every ilk who might gig on the side, partners who tend the home and family, off-the-grid homesteaders, and on and on. Some now in the gig economy might long to return to having just one job for one boss and benefits, but others have adapted to the fluidity of freelancing and short-term work. Among these are coaches and consultants who have clients instead of jobs, getting 1099s instead of W-2s. And then there are those who have truly independent means, family wealth, or other luck of the draw, and spend their time on their creativity or curiosity or service. Some, of course, are among the growing legion of FIers. Any of these will benefit from separating work from wages and seeing if this new mindset influences their choices of paid employment. Increasing numbers of people, though, are intent on building their wealth the way the wealthy often do, using their money to make money, from day traders to stock pickers to personal portfolio managers to real estate flippers. These people use their time and attention to maximize return as in any other job or business. In terms of this book, being a day trader is no different from being a heavy equipment operator or a scientist in a lab or a classroom teacher or a rock star. They are all jobs. Sometimes these investors do better than everyone in their high school class, and so there. Sometimes they come out ahead of at least what they would have earned on their planned profession. Sometimes they crash and burn. Making your money through investing is no more aligned with FI than making your money as a nurse practitioner or a real estate agent. No matter how you make money, there is a trade-off of time, of life energy. You should still evaluate your job, investing, the way you evaluate any other job. Ask yourself, what's my real hourly wage? Chapters 8 and 9 cover an approach to investing aligned with FI, financial intelligence, integrity, and independence. How to get a high-paying, high-integrity job. As we have seen, there is no job charming. The people we've met in these pages had to do a lot of soul-searching, risk-taking, experimenting, and challenging of old beliefs in order to move forward into jobs with higher pay and high integrity. They had to see that their lives are bigger than their jobs. The parts of them that were suffocated by their paid employment had to be given room to breathe again. Visions from childhood of how life could be had to be excavated from under the status, seriousness, and self-importance that masquerade as adulthood. They had to tell themselves the truth about whether their current paid employment was really doing what paid employment is supposed to do, earn money. There are a number of excellent job hunting guides and blogs on the market. Just one word of caution. As P.T. Barnum once said, there's a sucker born every minute. Be as smart a shopper for a job as you would be for a car or refrigerator. Nina N. had left her marriage and raised 4 children as a single mother 10 years before she started doing this program. Then she listened to the audio course, and even though she was living with friends exchanging labor for room and board, she started tracking her few expenses. Determined to become financially independent, she applied for a job as a maid at a nearby hotel and got it. She hurried home, ecstatic, to tell her housemates, only to realize she forgot to ask how much she'd be paid. Several months later, Nina moved to Seattle to look for a job that paid more than the minimum wage. Within weeks, she was out on assignments from a temporary employment agency. Right away, she put up her wall chart, and within a few months, she had wiped out several thousand dollars in debt. Her progress spurred her on. For every temporary position, she calculated her real hourly wage. Soon, she'd doubled her income, but she didn't stop there. Temping at a hospital, she learned of an opening as a full-time administrative assistant to a department head. She went for it. Her pay shot up above $17 per hour, and she now had benefits. Sure, she'd never had a job like this before, but she'd raised 4 children. How hard could one doctor be? But she didn't give up looking. Her wall chart was a daily reminder that the more she sold her life energy for, the sooner her time would be her own again. One weekend, while volunteering at a conference on a topic of interest, the whole staff walked off to protest a policy, and Nina stepped up. When the board went looking for a new executive director, Nina was the clear choice. By the time she retired, her annual salary was over $48,000, a figure that had been so unthinkable to the hotel maid Nina that she now had to tape extra graph paper to the top of her wall chart to even enter her monthly income. Her earnings had literally gone off the chart. See figure 7.1 in your PDF. Because of her focus on valuing her life energy, Nina quadrupled her income. Her self-image went from minimum wage worker to executive director. Step 7 is simply valuing your life energy and increasing your income, because the only purpose of paid employment is getting paid. You do not do this out of greed or competition, but out of self-respect and an appreciation for life. As a byproduct, you might well find yourself with less debt, more savings, more free time, more energy on the job, more energy off the job, more satisfied clients, a more satisfied family, and more peace of mind. Summary of Step 7. Increase your income by valuing the life energy you invest in your job, exchanging it for the highest pay consistent with your health and integrity. Money talk questions. Stories around a circle, be it a campfire or money talks, teach us so much about how to make better choices, not just for our money lives, but how to have more meaning and happiness. Enrich yourself by inviting others to speak and listen in this unique way. Using the suggestions in the epilogue for how to have a money talk, raise these questions in your daily reflections, or with your partner, or in social groups. Remember, adding why to the end of a question will take it deeper. Adding how has society shaped my answer to a question will take it wider. There are no right answers. How could you double your income without selling your soul or compromising your health? What was your first job? Your best job? Your worst job? What would be your dream job, whether or not you were paid for it? What is work and why do we do it? What is your life's work? What do you like and dislike about the work you do for money? Chapter 8, Catching Fire, The Crossover Point. So far, the byproduct of doing the steps has been minimizing your expenses, maximizing your income, paying off debt, and having your bank account start to grow. In the old days, you'd consider those savings spending money, a vacation, technology upgrades, a down payment for a new house. But now that you've done the steps, your old habits of spending everything you have and more on new stuff or experiences has quieted down. You know that money is your life energy, and you are determined to spend it only on what brings you joy and serves your purpose. Most of your old Gazingas pins no longer grab your attention, and those few that make it past the cash register often look like fool's gold very soon afterwards. You've started to feel the freedom of enough. What next? This is the moment when, if you are lucky, your successful Uncle Louie or Tia Rosalita or Cousin Archie sit you down for the quote-unquote magic of compound interest talk, the concept in which your money starts to work for you. They say, you're young. If you start saving now, by the magic of compound interest, you will be rich by the time you're 50. Me? Rich? Consider this chapter that talk and then some. Doing steps 1 through 7 transformed your relationship with money. Now steps 8 and 9 will transform your relationship with your future. Enter your successful Tia Rosalita, or Uncle Louie, or Cousin Archie, who explains that if you invest your savings rather than spending them, you will build wealth. Your money makes money for you. Store it in the bank and you get interest. Buy bonds and you get even more interest. Conservatively invest in the stock market and you get dividends. Reinvest all your interest in dividends and build more wealth. Eventually, my boy or girl, your money will do all the work for you. You will be financially independent. This relative is actually right by your side now. It's your wall chart. More powerful than you may realize, this simple snapshot of your financial life will help you transform your life in profound ways. Pay attention. It's simple once you see what's going on. Notice that once your expense line goes down, your income line goes up, your debt disappears, and you start having savings. In Chapter 7, we saw Nina N's wall chart with her income line going off the top. Let's take a look at it again this time adding the expense line. See figure 8.1 in your PDF. You'll notice that it settles into a groove. Having lived on the edge of poverty for so many years, Nina N. didn't have a lot of big spender habits to contend with, so her expense line soon settled in around 9.